Time flies, constant listeners. Episode 52. If we broadcast one episode per week, which is what we do, and we're at 52, that means this is the one-year anniversary of the Far Middle. I've had a blast the past year. I hope you enjoyed at least a few of these past 51 episodes. And when I started out with this, I didn't know if one episode per week would be able to sustain itself when you look at the perspective of content and whether or not we have enough timely issues to discuss. Boy, it was my concern and uncertainty. They were way off because the world today, it's chock full of all kinds of issues that we discuss here at the Far Middle. And what I tried to lay out in the book Precipice, content is certainly not in short supply. So happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary to me. And happy anniversary to the Far Middle podcast. Episode 52, being a milestone, it's going to need a worthy dedication subject. I think we have one at the ready. This is going to be a dedication to hard work, a dedication to grit, a dedication to greatness, and also a dedication to tragedy, I'm sorry to say. The person for our dedication of episode 52 goes to the late, the great, and the tragic Mike Webster. Iron Mike was born in Wisconsin, played collegiate ball for his home state Badgers. He was drafted by the Steelers in 1974, and when he came into the Steelers, he was able to study under the tutelage of Ray Mansfield, who was another great center, for a few years before he became a starter himself and proceeded to become what a lot of people consider to be the greatest center in the history of football. And the Steelers, as a football team, they have a special legacy when it comes to centers. Their lineage over the 50 years since 64 went almost without interruption from Ray Mansfield to Mike Webster, to Dermoni Dawson, then Jeff Hardings, and then Marquise Pouncey, probably four Hall of Famers in those five centers before it's all said and done. And Mike Webster was the most special of that special lineage, and maybe the most special of the Steelers dynasty teams in the 1970s. He came to epitomize the Steelers, and he became its leader on the offensive side of the ball, just like Mean Joe Green did the same on the defensive side. Mike Webster, he just was no frills. He was out there with no shirt sleeves in the dead of winter. He had those battered hands and a battered face. Mike Webster in January, he just looked like Pittsburgh. And in the late 70s, if you spent your career in a steel mill or a coal mine, like a lot of people here did back then, you took a look at Mike Webster and you assumed you made him one of your own. And it would turn out that he shared more with the blue-collar workers who built this nation than anyone knew at the time, which I'll get to in a minute. Iron Mike ended up wrapping up his professional career at Kansas City with the Chiefs. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame as soon as he became eligible, but what should have been the best time of his life after retirement quickly spiraled into a tragic mess. You see, Webster was battered so much over the years that he was disabled even before he hung up his jersey. His disability was cognitive and mental from all the head blows and head slaps and collisions in the trenches that he took over the years playing football. His battles with his ailments drove to substance abuse and a volatile behavior. His wife became estranged. He ended up broke and homeless, and he would disappear for days or weeks on end. Terry Bradshaw ended up helping him financially where he could. And ultimately, in 2002, Webster died of a heart attack. He was 50 years old. Half of what it should have been, his normal life, was stolen from him. Mike Webster was patient zero for what we call CTE today. And if you've seen the movie Concussion, which is a great movie, you know the story of Mike Webster and Dr. Amalu, who studied his case after his death. Doctors estimate the toll of Mike Webster's career. It was the equivalent of 25,000 automobile crashes. His estate and his family sued the NFL, and they won over $1 million in back disability payments. The NFL appealed that ruling and that case. The family won on appeal again, and now the NFL sets up all these funds for players who find themselves in Webster's situation. And unfortunately for players like Junior Seau, along with Mike Webster and others, the help comes way too late. And that Mike Webster dedication and story, it really brings me to the first dot to connect on this episode. I told you in many ways he was the ultimate Steeler because of how he epitomized the image and work ethic and approach of Pittsburghers back at the time working in mills and mines and factories. And through the years, I've come to realize another parallel between the people from earlier generations in my home region of Appalachia and Mike Webster. Our grandfathers and forefathers, they gave their lives, their health, and their well-being to their families when they worked constantly at jobs that didn't have the benefit of technology. Working in a steel mill in 1940 was a totally different experience than working in a modern mill today. Today, there are high-tech workers in work clothes using technology in those mills. Back then, there was no technology to speak of. All you had was the back and the sweat of the worker. And years of that would often make old men of young men in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, and even in the 1950s and early 1960s. Mike Webster was the professional athlete equivalent of those blue-collar workers before him. His job made him a broken and old man before he should have been, but he wanted to achieve, he wanted to earn, he wanted to provide. So he took the risk, he took the beatings, he achieved greatness, and he paid, in the end, the ultimate price. I don't know if we should be thinking of Mike Webster and smiling. I don't know if we should cry when we think of Iron Mike, maybe a little bit of both. But as a little kid watching him play, I loved him. And now I miss him. Here's to Iron Mike Webster, a man who achieved great things in his playing career and whose health trials and tribulations helped achieve understanding and aid and support for many others who came and suffered after him. Now, speaking of my beloved Steel City, I need to wrap up the topic that I started in prior episode 51, but we didn't have enough time to finish, about a few observations that were had during a night out on the town recently in downtown Pittsburgh. A quick recap, we went out to go have dinner and then see a play, an Agatha Christie play. Last episode, I talked about the pain and suffering that endures when a driver enters a major downtown area these days, much of it due to big government policies on public transportation and bike lanes and construction works projects, all of them making congestion worse to the point of unbearable, and how pandemic policies ended up killing off half the urban restaurants and left the other half overwhelmed and short-staffed and short-menued. Okay, so we're up to speed. We can move forward with the observations. The restaurant that we picked that night had the pizza that we wanted on the menu, so all was good for us, despite the shortened menu. Great meal, great staff at Siena Mercado in downtown Pittsburgh. Go support them if you can. Again, that's Siena Mercado, great restaurant. We walk to the theater after dinner. We get there, and we're told there are a few requirements that the theater has to allow us entry that we have to meet. And it's not just having or buying a ticket. You see, to go to the play at this venue, you have to also first be vaccinated. Second, you have to have your vaccination ID card showing that you're vaccinated and boosted. Third, you have to have your driver's license so you can prove, I guess, that you're not using a false vaccination card or someone else's vaccination card. And then last, you have to wear a mask at all times once you step inside the theater. So I look at this and I think, what's going on here? This is May of 2022. And this theater is a publicly funded enterprise, meaning taxpayers pay for it along with attendees who buy the tickets. It's funny how they're treating attendees almost like children or potential liars or maybe a little bit of both. And then I'm sure, right, the justification will be along the lines of something like protecting the public health as to why we have all of these measures that seem to be a bit obsolete and extreme. But then you think about it, the theater is selling every seat they can where the seats are close together. I think that becomes hugely, shall we be nice and say, inconsistent. Oh, but the inconsistency, it got worse. Because this play, this Agatha Christie play that we saw, what was known is in the round. That was the setup. It was in the round, which means the stage, it's in the middle of the floor, surrounded by audience seats on all four sides and very close to the stage itself. It's a cool setup, but it's very close between audience and actors, like maybe 3 feet away. If you look at the front row of the attendees and the stage itself or where the actors are. And the actors, of course, they're not wearing masks during the performance. So the paying customer goes through all these obsolete hoops that don't work in the end. The theater ends up selling every ticket they can without thinking about social distancing when it comes to revenues. And then the actors aren't inconvenienced like the audience is, and they're in the round right up against each other. So during the intermission of this play, we were allowed to get up and walk around. And something at this venue that I think you should be, I suppose, thankful for. But when we're walking around during intermission, the refreshments bar, the concession stands, they're closed. So no water, no drinks. Why? I don't know for sure, but maybe the real reason was due to being short-staffed on workers, and maybe, I don't know, the official reason was something like helping to stop the spread, whatever the case might be. Nevertheless, the play was good. The actors were great. As I said earlier, there's no such thing as bad Agatha Christie. So it's time to go home after the play. We exit the theater. We're walking to the parking garage to get the car. It's dark now. It's about 10 o'clock at night. And we're walking, and one thing permeates everything and everywhere on our way from theater to car. And that is weed, as in marijuana. It's coming out of the bars that we walk past. It's out on the street with people walking past on our way to the car. It's coming out of cars in traffic, at intersections and at lights, which got me to thinking, I'm not against marijuana, and I'm not against alcohol, and I'm not against driving, but I am against driving right after drinking a lot. And it got me to thinking how I'm a little unsettled or uneasy with the idea of somebody driving while or right after smoking pot. But a lot of people in our largest cities and communities, they're doing just that. And that can't be safe for any of us if response times are slowed down from the drug. So when you're driving out there, everybody always tells us you're only as safe as the least safe driver, or maybe we should say the most impaired driver. So we got home to end the night. I think initially when I got home, boy, I'm staying away from downtown for a bit, wait for a traffic lane to open up to cars instead of bikes, see if the theater drops their paperwork and DNA sample requirements effectively for admission in 2023. By the way, that performance had about two-thirds of the seats filled, which isn't good for a Saturday night, a big-name play everybody knows, and post-pandemic shutdowns when everyone is pent up and looking to go out and do things. I think these policies and the pain and suffering that people endure to spend an evening in some of our major cities, I think they have something to do with that. But, you know, I could say these things. I'm just kidding myself. I can't help it. It's Pittsburgh. I'll be back down there before you know it. I will be helping to stimulate the economy soon enough. And maybe instead of staying away, and instead I'll engage, and while I'm enjoying myself downtown, maybe I'll just advocate for some common sense changes and get the best of both worlds for everybody. Pittsburgh is one of those cities that's noted for its great universities, which brings me to the next dot to connect. If you recall, a few episodes back, we talked about surveys where the American public was listing climate change way down the list of top concerns that was on their minds in 2022. And this week, I saw some interviews that were held of students at Georgetown in D.C. The interviewer was asking the students what their top concern was at the present time. And a lot of these students had the programmed answer of climate change. It sort of shows you how campuses have gone from the marketplace of ideas to, in some ways, luxury indoctrination camps for the high-paying guests, to reality checks for the impressionable minds at Georgetown to offer up. First one is that their neighbors in D.C., a zip code or two away, that are in our underserved communities in D.C., they have a much, much higher risk from things like violent crime and the drug epidemic and poor healthcare access than from climate. And the data show this, it teases this out. You got 60 homicides year to date in Washington, D.C. Robberies are up 54%. Violent crime in total is up 25%. And you've got extreme outcomes and situations like 13-year-olds being arrested for multiple violent crimes. Now, some blame politics, some blame easy gun access, and some blame COVID. And maybe all of those, to certain extents, are contributing root causes. I'd worry much more about those individuals and those things today. And maybe we should send these Hoya students to see what's occurring in our underserved communities, and their perspective will change. But maybe not. Maybe they'll go take a look and they'll blame what they see on climate change. And by the way, the second perspective to offer up to the students at Georgetown, climate risk to human health, when you look at the data objectively, it is statistically and drastically falling, not rising, despite what you hear from media and the experts. So for every million people on Earth, annual deaths from climate-related causes, this is extreme temperature and drought, floods, storms, wildfires, declined 98%. It went from an average of 247 fatalities per million people per year in the 1920s down to 2.5 fatalities per million people per year in the 2010s. So that's the truth. Those are the data. Look it up if you like. But again, a perspective that you don't hear often enough about when you're talking and discussing all the issues surrounding climate change. Now, in big cities, you've got enclaves of affluent neighborhoods or pricey elite campuses that are completely clueless when it comes to what is occurring within a few blocks, a zip code over, or a subway stop further along the way in their own cities. And I've always been floored by how sharp and immediate transitions are in our big cities. There's the super wealthy and there's harsh poverty next to one another, on top of one another, and there's no middle class or nothing in the middle to transition to. And government policies have proven to do three things in our cities that lead to this reality. The first thing that it does, or they do, is that they're feeding and subsidizing the 1% and the affluent. It's basically a redistribution to the 1%. Second thing it achieves is that they grow the citizens that are subjected to harsh poverty and everything that comes with it. I've mentioned a few of those already, crime and drug epidemics and failed schools and a high cost of living. And then the third thing these policies do in our large cities is that they destroy the middle class. They eradicate it. They run it out of town or they crush it into poverty. This unfortunate, yet I believe accurate, view of big cities and government policies, it always resurfaces in my mind each year when it's time for that orgy of excess, megalomania, and narcissism of the elite. And I'm talking about the Met Gala in New York City. Now, I'm not sure if you've ever paid attention to it, but if you are normal and balanced in your life, the event's going to make your stomach churn. Now, every year has a theme at the gala. The theme this year was In America, an Anthology of Fashion. And the dress code was, quote, gilded glamour, end quote. Okay, if I'm going to an event and they give me that dress code, I'm immediately sending my regrets because I don't even want to put a fraction of the time or money into what it would take to figure that out. I don't know what gilded glamour means. Now, First Lady Jill Biden, she kicked off the week's events. In her opening remarks, the First Lady said that style helps us express things that can't be put into words. Now, that I found to be a little bit ironic coming from the spouse of a president who seems to struggle these days to put anything sensical into words. And you had the normal murderer's row of annoying celebrities at the event. You had everybody from political hacks to the social media mooks. You had 600 of the most pretentious people you'd ever meet packing it in at the Upper East Side venue. You had every Kardashian in attendance, of course, including one who wore the Marilyn Monroe dress that she was wearing when she sang Happy Birthday to JFK, whose worth is put in the millions of dollars. Mayor Adams of New York City, he was there in a tuxedo. His tux paid homage to New York's public transit system and made a gun control statement on the back. Hillary Clinton was there, maskless as her dress attendant wore a mask, not a great optic there. You had lots of Ukraine solidarity messages at the event, but no one there gave any indication of a willingness to do anything tangible when it came to regarding the plight of the Ukraine. In the event, it's a hugely corporate one. Vogue was charging $1 million for 2 6-second spots on its Met Gala live stream over the course of 2 hours. Tables were running at $200,000 per. Some of the proceeds went to a fashion-centric nonprofit, but a lot of it went to for-profit entities like Vogue. And hey, I'm not opposed to any of this as it relates to the fashion industry or the money flows or the promotion of it. I believe in capitalism and the free market and individual rights and freedom of expression. No, it's not that or those things that are the problem, at least from my perspective. The problem I have is with the irony and the hypocrisy. So take the gilded glamour theme. I thought 90% of the attendees to the gala feel that the Gilded Age was evil, along with capitalism and business that went with it or gets associated with it. Mayor Adams, he's at the event promoting the subway and gun control on his tux, but then you wonder how many riders were assaulted that day on the transit system, and you wonder how many citizens were shot in the streets that day and night. Someone should map out the location of those incidents versus the Met location when the gala was held to see how far away it was from the elite ball. I'm guessing some of the locations would show shocking proximity, and we all accept it, and life goes on. When I see all the pomp and the photos from this event, my mind always shifts to a kid or a young adult living a little further north from the Met, maybe in Harlem, maybe the Bronx, wherever, as long as it's not Midtown or the Upper East Side enclaves. What's life like for him or her? And what are his or her prospects for the future? Are the schools educating them? Are the streets safe for them? Do they have adequate support systems, mainly family in place, and so on? Why not make this concern the focal point of the Met Gala moving forward? Turn those charity proceeds over to charter schools or rehab efforts or career training for the next generation. Use the spotlight of the Met Gala to expose and help address the real problems existing blocks away, not abstract ideals that defy tangible markings. How much better New York City would be with such a shift in the mindset. Now you head south from the Met Gala that's in the Upper East Side and you go down to the tip of Manhattan. You're going to find Wall Street down there and the New York Stock Exchange and those cramped lower Manhattan caverns, which brings me to the next dot to connect. You may know by now, if you've been listening, I am fascinated by investing in markets. It's sort of like my interest in sports and food and music and wine. I enjoy them all and I love learning about them, but in the end, I couldn't do any of them or make any of them with any skill. So with that warning on my investing in market acumen out of the way, or my lack thereof, let me give you an update on the market. We've discussed Fed policy and how it created asset bubbles and stocks and bonds, among other things. In prior episodes, we talked about TINA, there is no alternative, where everyone has to crowd into equities in a negative real rate world. And we also discussed in the past how frothy valuations have become and what inflation will do to valuations. So a few of you have been asking me to update views with all the recent volatility we experienced in the markets of late. Well, my conclusion as to view is basically the same, and that is that equities look highly, highly valued, perhaps to the point of being overvalued. And there are a bevy of favored valuation metrics that support that view that I just gave you. Five key metrics in particular. So you've got price to sales ratio, the Shiller CAPE, the price to book ratio, enterprise value to sales ratio, and then enterprise value to EBITDA ratio. All five of those metrics are sitting at the extreme end. I mean, the very extreme end of the valuation spectrum, as in the high end. Two more key metrics, so the trailing 12 months PE ratio and the next 12 months PE ratio, they're not as high or as extremely in the far end of the spectrum, but they are definitely on the richly valued end of the spectrum versus history. So those additional two, they're not looking real good either. Not as bad as the first five, but not good by any stretch. The only metric I can find that is close to the middle of the historical data set on equity valuations is the price to free cash flow ratio. That's the only one that's sort of not extreme. It's not indicating undervalued, it's just indicating fairly valued. So the Federal Reserve rapidly raising interest rates and going to quantitative tightening. You've got China teetering. You've got negative GDP for the U.S. economy. You got war in Ukraine. You got inflationary beasts raging. You got $30 plus trillion in government debt, rudderless leadership in D.C., and historically high market valuations. Yeah, I remain skittish and nervous on stocks and bonds. But not only am I not an expert, I didn't even stay at a Holiday Inn last night. So what do I know? Then again, what do the experts know? All right. Enough of all this big city New York talk. We've reached the 2-minute warning for Landmark Episode 52. Let's bring it back home with a discussion of a prominent Pittsburgher who played actually a pivotal role in Mike Webster, Dr. Amalu, and the CT situation. I'm talking about Dr. Cyril Wecht. Dr. Wecht was Dr. Amalu's boss, and you see his role when watching the movie Concussion. He basically provided the cover and the resources to let Dr. Amalu do his thing early on in the Webster and CTE affair. So without Wecht's support, it's fair to speculate that Dr. Amalu's work might not have been happened or might not have seen the light of day. And if you know Dr. Wecht, and a lot of people from these parts know him, you know he would have been the perfect cover to shield Dr. Amalu from the heat. Dr. Wecht is a force of nature. Even at 91 years old today, I'm sure he still is a force of nature. Dr. Wecht was raised in the city of Pittsburgh, and he went on to earn both an MD and a JD. So he's a doctor as well as an attorney. He served in the Air Force, and then he was elected and served as Allegheny County coroner for two tenures spanning a decade each. So he was the coroner for basically 20 years, Allegheny County being the county where Pittsburgh sits within. Now, Dr. Wecht has performed over 14,000 autopsies, and he is a global authority on high-profile deaths or crimes. Now, which ones did he work on or was consulted on? Ones that span American history, politics, and culture for over 50-plus years. Robert F. Kennedy, Sharon Tate with respect to the Manson murders, Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, the Symbionese Liberation Army shootout, JFK and the Warren Commission. He played a pivotal role with that. The Legionnaire's disease outbreak, for those of you that remember that tragedy, Elvis Presley's death, Kurt Cobain's suicide, Joan Benet Ramsey. I think he was also involved with Sonny Von Bulow and the Branch Davidian incident down in Texas, Lacey Peterson, and then Daniel and Anna Nicole Smith. So, you know, again, that basically spans 50 plus years of American politics and culture. He wrote over a dozen books. He's a prolific writer. He teaches and taught at Pitt and at Duquesne University. He founded the Wecht Institute at Duquesne University. He chaired the Democratic Party in Allegheny County. He lost a bid to keep the chairmanship of the Democratic Party in Allegheny County to a guy named Ed Stevens, who was another great guy, but he was also one of my customers on my paper route when I was a kid, and I went to school with his daughter. I've known her for years. My mom worked for Dr. Wecht at the coroner's office for years in Allegheny County in downtown Pittsburgh. He was tough to work for. I can tell you that listening to her firsthand, but he was extremely loyal to his team. And you get the feeling that Pittsburgh is the world's biggest small town, right? You've got Ed Stevens, who I delivered papers to. My mother worked for Dr. Wecht. Everybody knows Dr. Wecht. Everybody knows everybody else in Pittsburgh. It's not 6 degrees of separation. It's 2 degrees of separation. Look, Dr. Wecht, he is a to-the-point, brilliant, and in-your-face man. Politics sometimes play a role with him. He can be very political. He can also sometimes be partisan. He can be opinionated. Sometimes he can be petty. Yet he is a giant in his space, and he is a Pittsburgher, and he was someone who was very good to my family. I love the guy. Let's take a note from Dr. Wecht. You're never too old to keep achieving. There's no telling what you can accomplish if you work hard and stay at it. Till next week and the start of year 2 of the Far Middle Podcast, farewell.